All right, so my name is Allison Royhelm. I am, among other things, a philosopher. And so I'm going to say some things about thinking that not every philosopher agrees with, but some do. So my sermon is called Thinking Things. And as you heard in the story from Terry Bassan that Robbie read, we often think of ourselves as thinking things. So as you were listening to that story, did you imagine they were talking about humanity? It's never stipulated. It's never stipulated that the race they're talking about lives on the third planet from their sun, or that they're in the outer arm of the galaxy, or anything that might help you to pin down that they're actually talking about us, just that it's thinking meat. We're like, oh, we're meat, and we think, right? So the story by Terry Bassan presents an interesting kind of question. What kinds of things are capable of thinking? Do we know them by their works, the things they do, or what they're made of? Right? In that conversation, people were persuaded to think that whatever race they're talking about was thinking because of the things they accomplished and did, right? Not what they're made of. But they found what they're made of repulsive. So we humans are indeed, I think, thinking things. And our thoughts about our thinking can be used as a fundamental proof of our own existence as individuals. As René Descartes famously said in his Meditations, I think, therefore I am. A lot of people have heard those words, but not necessarily the context around them. So he said this in the context of examining what, if anything, we can actually know to be true. Suppose Descartes said that an evil demon, or in our modern age, maybe a computer simulation, has manufactured for me totally illusory sensations, right? They're coming in, but they're not real in any sense by which we'd use the word real. I then could not trust any of my sense data about the external world. Am I awake or am I asleep? Am I being fooled or is this all really happening? Right? Maybe I'm not really here and you're not really here and you don't exist. What can I tell? Right? What can I know? I cannot at any point be precisely certain these sensory impressions of the world are true in any sense. And even if I'm not being manipulated, I still cannot be sure how true they are, for I can perceive only part of the picture, both because I'm an individual and because my senses do not perceive all that exists. There are colors I will never see, degrees of translucency I will never perceive, smells I can never detect. Well, Descartes said, what then can I know? Is there anything I can absolutely know is true? We can at least know that if we are deceived, he said, there is something to be deceived that exists. If we are only partial knowers, there is a knower. If I am thinking, there is a thinker, and I am that thinker. And this, at least, of all things, I can know. The philosopher Martin Heidegger examined the nature of human existence in the world, what he called being in the world. He uses little dashes in the English translation. We usually use dashes to say being in the world, like it's all one word, because the German word is Dasein, which is a word he made up, because in German you can just make up words. It's fantastic for philosophy. He argued that we use our tools, our forks, our hammers, our pens, our clothing, the thing to ring the bell, right? All these external objects as extensions of ourselves and our being. So you noticed when Alex came up to light the chalice, right? The thing went out. The lighter went out. It had to be relit up here. Up until it went out, he was just carrying the fire and he was going to do this thing and it was like an extension of his body. It goes out and everybody's like, oh God, we got to fix this. And suddenly we're paying attention to the object that we weren't paying attention to before. We were just paying attention to lighting the chalice. Now we're paying attention to the object. So Heidegger says all these tools, we see them as extensions of ourselves and our being, and we hardly really notice them until they break, right? And then our being can't be extended through them. It is only when the hammerhead is loosely fitted and does not hammer properly that we notice it as fully distinct from ourselves. Otherwise, we just reach for it and hammer. Only when the pen is out of ink and we tap it on the page and then scribble, right, to no good end, that we think about it as a pen. Otherwise, we're just like, oh, I need to write now. Okay. In this way, we extend ourselves and our agency into the world. Thus, said Heidegger, the nature of us is not just thinking things, but this being in the world where we're connected. There's, of course, more to his ideas, but this is the only part I'm taking today. Feminist philosophers have long adapted Heidegger and other theories of human existence and ethics to note that we are in relation to persons as well as objects at all times. And these relations are essential to our being, that without them we are not fully human. They become most apparent as relations also when they are broken and in need of repair. And any theory of what is most valuable that does not take these relations into account, say these feminist philosophers, is inadequate because these relations are so fundamental to our nature and what it is to be human. And the core of these relations, many point out, are emotions. And emotions are fundamental to our nature as much as thinking is. In fact, I'm going to argue that we shouldn't treat these as two separate things, even though we usually do. And I'm a philosopher, so bear with me because I can't help but make arguments. It's now how I exist. All right. So consider the work of Antonio Damasio, a neurologist with a philosophical bent. In his book, Descartes' Error, Damasio concerns himself with one implication of the notion that we are thinking things. That is that non-logical thoughts are not properly called thoughts at all, right? Rather, that emotions and thoughts derived from emotions are a kind of pollution of reason. You've probably heard this idea. Don't get so emotional. Stop and think, as though those two things can't possibly be compatible, right? We prize reason, right? And if emotions are a threat to it, then we're going to have to get rid of them, right? The Enlightenment in Western Europe owes an enormous debt to this idea, the idea that we must pursue knowledge and truth, and that it is in our nature to do so. And also that emotionality is against this quest, is an obstacle in the journey towards capital T truth, right? It gives us science, but it also has given us a highly gendered and judgmental notion of men as rational and women as irrational. This has status implications for women as knowers precisely because of the deep division between emotion and reason that has persisted for centuries in Western philosophy. One of the things that has come out every time Hillary Clinton has run for office is that somebody says, "What if she's got her finger on the button when she gets her period?" Apparently not realizing that she's been in menopause for a while, right? But nonetheless, you've got somebody then who is really committed to this idea that women are emotional or rational would then say, "Oh, but menopause, you get these mood swings, right? And then she couldn't possibly be trusted to make good judgments." So men don't have hormones. Right? And there's this kind of idea that somehow emotion is an obstacle to reason. Women are emotional, men are rational. This gets used and deployed all the time without us even really thinking about it in daily life. So what we get then is the notion that women become obstacles to every pursuit based on reason. They're not fit for science, they're not fit for philosophy. This is used to explain why they're, quote, not good at math, in the words of some people who famously were then appointed to major positions in the Obama administration. And I can give you a citation for that at some other point if you really want it. So what we have here is this idea that if we restrict ourselves and get rid of emotion, we will be better thinkers, right? We'll be more fully human. But suppose for just a moment that restricting men to rationality, untrammeled by emotion, is in fact an impoverishment of their own capacities, that it strips them of the ability to think in certain ways and express certain things. If they're not allowed to do that or are told that being rational means not thinking about those kinds of issues. Suppose that restricting human reason to pure rationality is an impoverishment of thinking. Damasio actually takes up this concern in Descartes' Error. It's why he has the title of the book. It's not Descartes' total correctness in all things, right? He presents numerous cases in which excessive emotion appears to go along with utter unreasonableness, as in the cases of substance abuse, or of Phineas Gage, who you may have learned about in high school or middle school, who had a metal rod shot into his brain during a railroad construction accident in the 19th century, damaging his cognitive function somewhat and making him prone to swings of emotion. Gage then proceeded to run on violent emotion-fueled rampages in his home and community. But, Damasio notes, this famous case of Gage usually leaves out that prior to the accident which impaired his cognition, he had a noted tendency for violent rages. right? So it's not that by damaging his brain, suddenly he was dangerous and unable to think, right? He had always struggled with this, and whatever inhibitions he'd had previously had been weakened by this incident. Damasio also presents the case of a modern man who had a brain injury due to a medical procedure, and after this injury, the man could neither feel nor display emotion or attachment. He retained his intelligence and the mathematical and reasoning skills he had learned, and if asked to calculate the odds on investments, he'd been a banker, he could tell you the odds accurately and which investment would be most profitable. Asked to tell you what you should do, he would say, "I don't know." He could evaluate the purely logical factors of any argument, comparing two or more courses of action, but he did not care about the outcome. So when asked what you should do, he would say, "I don't know." He could not translate his reasoning into a conclusion because he didn't care what the answer was. Damasio takes from this, and other cases like it, that some degree of emotionality is essential to the way that human reason works, to the way that humans think. Emotions can be an obstacle, and rationality can help to turn us into reasonable beings, into properly thinking things, but rationality without emotions is not the same as reasonableness at all. We need both. Philosophers such as Karen Jones have also picked up on this, working to describe the ways in which emotions can, well, be rational, by helping us to pick out which of many, many factors in a situation are relevant to us, should matter to us. So you're looking around this room right now, there are all kinds of bits of information in this room. But the one that you're focusing on is me because I'm noisy and I'm amplified, right? And maybe you're actually engaged. But you could be focusing on the little curlicues on the chandelier, right? You could be thinking to yourself, did that used to be for candles? I've thought this occasionally during hymns and stuff, right? Is that for candles and they rewired it? And if so, how did they get the rewiring through the actual structure, right? Or was it made to be electric? So you could be doing this, but you're making judgments all the time about what's relevant or salient, and emotion seems to be part of why you make that judgment, okay? So there are all kinds of ways where when something happens that triggers our emotions, we readjust our judgments of what is relevant. And the classic Enlightenment view would say, you're not thinking straight. But there is a view of reason and reasonableness that would say, aha, that's what you need to think straight, at least sometimes. So taken together, then, we have some rather lovely thoughts about ourselves as thinking beings. And yes, I'm a total nerd, so I think they're lovely. But still, I think they're lovely. First, the most basic and true thought we can have is that we exist, and we can know this because we think. Second, we exist in the world in an interconnected and relational way, and this, too, is fundamental to our nature. By adding the thoughts of feminist philosophers like Virginia Held, Hilda Lindemann, and Margaret Urban Walker, we can see this relationality expressed in the web that connects us. That sounds familiar? Interconnected web, interdependent web of all existence, right? We see this relationality expressed in the web that connects us to one another, not only through daily action and interdependence, but also on the emotions that keep the strands of that web alive and humming, for good or ill. Damasio and Jones lead us to see ways in which, without these emotions, not only are we not relational, but we are not even fully ourselves as thinking things. Right? Without these emotions, we're not even thinking things. And this, too, I would argue, is fundamental to our nature. We cannot demand of each other pure reason, and we ought not demand of each other pure reason. But perhaps what we can demand of each other is reasonableness. As Louis Vaughan notes in discussing how we can reason about subjects like medical ethics, it would be strange in the extreme for someone to say that they thought physician-assisted suicide is wrong, and then, when asked why, to say, "Oh, I don't have any reasons, I just think it is." Right? Vaughan describes the demand for reasons in thinking as a demand for reasonableness. And I like this formulation much better than this kind of abstract logical rationality stuff. In this sense, then, reason is a rescue from people just making claims. While we cannot guarantee that we will share emotions from one person to another via words, though rhetoricians know well how to make this happen, we can share reasons. And this may, in fact, be central to democracy. This very idea is carved on the outside of the Peabody Opera House, as those of you who marched yesterday or have attended events there may know. A quote from Carl Schurz is just to the left of the grand entrance. It says, "Democratic government will be the more successful, the more the public opinion ruling it is enlightened and inspired by full and thorough discussion." Sharing of reasons. And on the other side of the grand entrance, these words from Woodrow Wilson. "Simple means should be found by which, by an interchange of points of view, we may get together. For the whole process of modern life is a process by which we must exclude misunderstandings, bring all into common counsel, and so discover what is in the common interest." Surely this requires reasonableness of just the sort we've been discussing and must allow for us to have both logic and emotion. Let us not dismiss the speech of others because they are angry. Let us seek to understand why they are angry and to understand that as a reason. Let us not dismiss the speech of others because they are afraid. Let us seek to understand why they are afraid and to understand that as a reason. Let us not dismiss the speech of others because their positions are based in love or compassion. Let us seek to understand what implications this has if we take those emotions seriously as reasons. Does this mean we simply must be relativists? That all positions are equal? Somebody could say, well, I just feel that white people are, right? No, not at all. Of course not. We have to demand reasons. Emotion can be one of them, but it can't be all. Because we are balancing here. We are balancing logic and emotion as reasons, as part of rationality, as part of being thinking beings. Some thoughts are, well, more reasonable than others. But it is not the presence of logic and the absence of emotions that makes it so. Emotions can be reasons. And when we demand reasonableness of others and of ourselves, we can require that we lay out our reasons for ourselves and for each other. Nothing is right merely because it feels right. Reason is a rescue from the folly of being not thinking but purely feeling creatures. But neither are things wrong because our feelings play a role in our determination of their rightness. Okay? Neither are things wrong because our feelings play a role in our determination of their rightness. To be thinking things is to be reasonable. It is not to be emotionless, nor is it to be merely feeling things. Let us go forth and be whole humans.